Okay, today is Dhamma Talk, one of the ones which I promised earlier on during question time, is on enlightenment. So I'm going to tell you today what you're getting into. Actually, for most of you, it's too late now anyway. And nevertheless, it is what's going to happen, and why. And it's important to describe enlightenment. I know that sometimes that people have said these strange things about enlightenment. Things like, he who says doesn't know. He who knows doesn't say. Sounds really good. That's said in that book. Whoever said that didn't know. But more than that, sometimes say it's beyond comprehension. It's ineffable. It's beyond words. And it reminded me of a story when I was young and interested in spiritual things. Obviously, growing up in London, you know, for mostly Christian culture, I was really also interested in this idea of like God. So I used to ask all these, my teachers and the chaplain at school, what is God anyway? And he said, God is beyond words. It's ineffable. He who knows doesn't say something about that. And that's one of the reasons I gave up Christianity, because that to me sounded like people didn't know what they were talking about. Whenever you get mysterious on mystical answers, that's a sure sign the person is making it up as they go along. If they knew what they were talking about, they'd be able to explain it to you. So, and give up Christianity, then you started getting into Buddhism. So you saw some of these lamas and some of these monks and say, what is this enlightenment anyway? And they say, it's ineffable, he who says it's enlightenment. I've heard that before somewhere, you know what you're talking about. So a lot of times I didn't know what they were talking about. And because you don't know what you're talking about, you don't know what the goal is, sometimes what are you doing this for? I'm striving to get enlightened. What enlightenment is, I'm not quite sure, but I'm striving to get it. It's quite stupid, isn't it? So, today I'm going to tell you what it actually is and how it happens, and so you need to know what you're doing. So again, the path of the Buddha, who's obviously the main example of what enlightenment is, was actually to find out what's going on in life, which is obviously one of the great sort of quests of human beings. What the heck are we doing here? And actually, who are we, and why are we, and what's going on? And that's always been the way of finding that out, is not through philosophy or thinking. If ever you followed philosophy, I think it was the early part of this century, or middle of this century, the philosophers came to a complete dead end. Because what they actually found out was that you can't prove anything. You can't prove anything. You can't prove anything at all. They got themselves into this knot which they could go no further. Which is actually quite true, because thinking just always misses the point. So trying to find out the truth of things, who you are, what life is all about, just through the intellect, all you get is arguments. And nothing is ever convincing. So instead of that, now the Buddha would always actually reject the arguments and thoughts of others to actually find out for himself. In that morning chant, they say, Pachatang Vegetapo Vinyuhi, to be seen, or really to be known, each person by themselves. So this is actually how we can get to this enlightenment business. The point is, everybody has to make that journey. And that journey is always inside. As I said earlier on in this retreat, you don't find the beginning and the end of the world sort of by looking in the past or looking for the future. But the creation myth in Buddhism is actually inside this moment, to be experienced now. It's not some sort of thousands of years earlier. And that's why sometimes people ask Buddhists, what about the origin of the world? How can you explain the world was created? And you say, go inside your mind in jhana and you see yourself creating the world right now. So that's our creation. And that's something you don't need an astronomer or belief to find, because you can see that for yourself right in this moment. So go inside and see the Creator, the will. But you want to find out who is that? Because when you actually look for like a Christian idea of the first cause, it's what creates things, it is will. So what is the ultimate will? So instead of trying to look for the ultimate will through thoughts or up in the stars, it's one of those stories in the book which was fascinating. That a couple of years ago, there was some sort of anniversary in Perth. I forget what it was the anniversary of, but they're having a few events. And one of the events, they had a little panel discussion on science versus religion. It was done at the old Perth Observatory, just next to Parliament House. So I was invited to go on the panel, to give a short talk and answer questions from the audience. It was actually religion versus science, and they had the state astronomer, they had a couple of one PhD in physics from the university, and somebody else. And against them they had, she was a Catholic priest or an Anglican priest, and they invited me because I was a Buddhist. But what they didn't realise, I had the stuff on those guys, because I was a physicist before, they didn't realise that. So I had the stuff on them all. So one of the wonderful things was a question which they asked. This was at the question time. This lady stood up, obviously a very honest and sincere person. She said, "Every time I look through a telescope at the heavens and the stars, I feel my Catholic religion is threatened." What she meant, like the science and what it said in her books, they didn't meet. They asked for the comments on that. Because every time she looked in the heavens and leapt through a telescope and saw all those stars, those universes, they were so old. Way before the creation of the universe, according to her books. So she felt her religion really threatened. What was that out there? And they asked my comment, and my comment was, if any scientist look through that telescope the other way round, from the fat end, the wide end, to the narrow end, to see the one who's watching, then science is threatened. And that's very true, because it is threatened. Because science is all about the known, but when it gets like, who's knowing this, who's experiencing this, my goodness, science can't answer that, they start to get all wobbly. Now, the point is that that's always going to be the place where you look. Not just out there, what you're knowing, but who's doing the knowing. Not the effects of your actions, the results of your will, but actually where's this will coming from. That's why we call it the path of insight, seeing inside what's going on. And a metaphor which I manufactured some years ago. Again, this is an original Ajahn Brahm metaphor. I've got the patent rights on this. The franchise, if you want to use it, you can. It was a simile of like the person on the bus journey. But that's what sometimes life is like. It's an old metaphor, the metaphor of life's journey. And your bus sometimes goes through the most delightful scenery. It's so beautiful, rolling meadows and beautiful trees and lakes and rivers and waterfalls and wonderful flowers. Oh, it's so wonderful. But you ask the bus driver, "Oh, please slow down, even stop. I want to enjoy this happiness as long as possible." And what does the bus driver do? More often than not, he speeds up. Oh, the happy times, they don't seem to last as long as they should do. And sometimes that bus goes through this terrible scenery. Wastelands, toxic dumps. And it looks so awful. And you tell the bus driver, "Oh, this is so awful, so painful to see, to experience. Please, speed up. Get out of here as soon as you can." And more often than not, the bus driver slows down. Sometimes they even stop. Your painful experiences in life, why do they last so long? When you tell the bus driver, your will, "Hurry up, get out of here. I don't want to have pain, I don't want to have sadness, I don't want to have grief, I don't want to worry so much, I don't want to have this restless mind in meditation, get out of here, quick." And sometimes you do get these beautiful states of meditation. "Oh, slow down. Shh, enjoy this." And the bus driver puts his foot on the accelerator before you know it. So you can see the nature of that simile, what it really means. The buzz drop, the buzz is life. The beautiful scenery outside the window is your happy times, which don't seem to last as long as they should. And the unpleasant experiences which you see through the window is your pain and suffering, which comes and seems to last longer than it should. And your job is to try and train this bus driver. To train your will, so make sure you get happy experiences all the time. Or maybe a few unhappy ones, but not very long. You want to train your bus driver to make sure he speeds out of the unpleasant areas and slows down, lingers, and even stops for a picnic in the happy times of your life. But, having tried that many, many times, you failed. Many times in your life you wonder, why am I suffering so much? Why is happiness so fleeting? Why can I control all of this? So, you realize that you have to find out who is actually driving this bus. And teach that bus driver to train that bus driver. So, your spiritual life very often is searching for the bus driver of your life. The one who's at the wheel. The one who keeps putting the foot on the accelerator and not on the brake at the wrong time. You want to find that person out. Now where can you find the bus driver? It's not outside the bus. It's right in the seat, the front seat of you. So that's what meditation does. It goes in and in and in until you see the bus driver's seat. You manage to find your way to the front of the bus. In this simile means you've got deep into your mind. You've gone past the five senses in this physical body. You've gone past the future and the past. You've gone past all these words and you've got in. And you can start to see just the mind in its final little shakings. When you've got like nimittas coming up, sometimes you can see something grabbing it, sometimes pushing it away. You see the seat of your will. And when you get to that bus driver's seat, you get a shock. You see something you never expected. You experience what is beyond reason. The bus driver's seat is empty. No one there. It's a driverless bus. Anatta, non-self. Now when you see that, of course that shocks. Ah, I'm not here. But you see all the controls, you see why it works. It's cause and effect, programming, that's all it is. And the result of that, the result of seeing there's no driver of you, is you go back to your seat, you sit down, and you stop complaining. There's no one to shout to anymore. There's no one to say, oh you stupid monk, you did this same simile last week. Oh, you stupid monk, you still keep on saying these same old talks. Oh, you brilliant monk, you inspired so many people this weekend. You start complaining or praising. There's no one to complain to. There's no one to praise anymore. You begin to let go. Craving and ill will get undermined when there's no one to crave, when there's no one to have ill will towards. How can you get angry at somebody? There's no one in there. It's completely a waste of time. So, seeing the driverless bus, the seat of you, is vacant. Oh, what a relief. You sit in your seat and you stop complaining. Beautiful scenery comes, that's life. Unpleasant scenery comes, that's life. So you stop arguing with life. If you stop arguing with life, that solves a lot of your problems. That's why sometimes when people complain about their husband, I say, what do you expect? I expect my husband to be like, come on, get real. What do you think husbands are like? You complain about your wife. What do you expect? You expect your wife to be fully enlightened with no personal desires and not ever getting angry at you? If she was like that, she wouldn't be your wife. She'd come into the nunnery. Come and know. What do you expect of your children? You can't get all the children becoming lawyers and doctors. My goodness. So, sometimes what do we expect? We expect stupid things. Sometimes we get sick and we expect, oh, the monk will prison charge, we get better and we live forever. Oh, come on. It's too many people. Some have got to die. And at you. Then his body got well, didn't have work for the doctors. So after a while, sometimes our expectations are completely unreasonable. Once you see the driverless bus, where can there be any expectations? So we start to accept life as it truly is. We become at peace. We begin to really let go, not just, you know, playing letting go, which is you're doing when you meditate. Really only just playing letting go, it's not for real. But when you see the driverless bus, it's for real. You can't do anything else, it's obvious. But that seeing the driverless bus and letting go is part of the experience of emptiness, non-self, the anatta, which leads to the first stage of enlightenment, which is stream-winning, seeing non-self. Because once that happens, the process is underway. Your idea of self, your cravings and everything else is terminally wounded. There's no possibility of doing it anymore, of craving. Or you can crave because the old habits, but they're going to die. They are mortally wounded. The cause of them has been completely undermined. And soon you're not going to crave anymore, nothing you want anymore, because there's no one left to do the wanting. As I said, I think in a, I think I gave this simile, in the interviews, it's like sometimes that we think as a Buddhist the path is non-attachment. And have you tried the path of non-grasping? Sometimes people try that path. I tried that path for many years, not grasping. This is what I did. It was like my hand picking up things. I pick up something and I say, "You're grasping again, bro. Stop it." I put it down. A few minutes later, I'll be picking up something else. "You've done it again. Stop it." A few minutes later, you pick up something else. "There you go again. Leave it alone. Stop picking up things. Pick up something else." I was always picking up things. When you became a monk, you put down girls. And soon I found myself taking up food. Food is very important for young monks. So you gave that away. You're picking something else up. Then you're picking something else up. And this is grasping business was endless. You ever notice that? You give up one thing and then you pick up another. Sometimes, you know, you give up, you know, your TV and start picking up jars. Glass, glass, glass. Whatever it is, you always tend to pick up things. Why are you always graspers? And I realized, and this was actually my own insight, I realized, hang on, Ajahn Brahm, that's what a hand does. That's what a hand is made for. That's its function. That's its nature. The nature of a hand is to pick things up. What we've got five fingers for. So I said, how can I stop my hand performing its natural function? And I realized there's only one way for a hand not to grasp. And what's that? Cut it off. Cut off your hand and throw it away, then you can't grasp anymore. And I realized that's the same with the path to enlightenment. The only way for you to stop picking things up, grasping things, grasping husbands, grasping wives, grasping partners, grasping children, grasping money, grasping fame, grasping even meditation, as if it's like yours, the only way you can stop grasping is cut off the grasper. You, the sense of self, me, the I. Because that's what the self does. That is its function. As long as you've got a sense of you, you'll always grasp things. That's where craving and ill will come from. It comes from a sense of me. As long as there's a me there, you'll have ill will or you'll have craving. Because that's the nature of that particular illusion which we call the illusion of self. I can imagine what I felt because I worked that simile out myself as a monk in Thailand. When I got back to Australia, started looking at some of the suttas, started reading them in English, had some good translations at last, and I came across the sutta in the Sanghita Nikaya, the sutra of the hands and the feet, where I saw the Buddha thought of that before. That's a sense of shivers down my spine. Did I invent that simile? Or was that some dim recollection of some previous life? Because almost word for word, the simile of the hand, picking things up, is the simile first said by the Buddha. Ooh, that was good. But the point was, it was a great simile. And it showed actually what I really had to do. If you want to get enlightened, if you want to stop grasping onto things, and stop your craving, you won't be able to do that unless you see the bus driver's seat. You see who or what is doing all this craving business. What is his will, this doer? So, in order to see that, this is why we meditate. And there comes a time, because you're suppressing the doer, you're suppressing the five senses, that you can see it. So I mentioned in that simile before, and it's a powerful simile, the simile of the tadpole. Only when the tadpole becomes a frog and leaves the water can it know what water is. That's a very powerful simile. Only when you leave the doer, there's no doing left, there's no will left, you get into the jhana, only then can you know what will truly is. Otherwise it's all inference, theory, speculation. And it can never really be true understanding. Which is why, this is in the suttas, I say this, other monks argue with me, other senior monks argue with me, but I stand my ground on this. That the only way to get those enlightened experiences is by the use of jhanas. Through jhanas, there's no other way. There's no other way you can get the insights, the experience, the raw data, which can actually tell you what self is, what doing is, what consciousness is. You can have inference, you can have faith, you can hear it well explained, think, oh, that makes sense to me, but that's not the same as seeing it for yourself. Even if you get jhana, sometimes you don't see it, but at least you've got the data there. The data to see what it is which creates the world. What it is that actually does and wills. The driver of your seat, of your bus, sorry. When you become someone who gets into jhanas, it is like leaving your lake. You've got outside of that known world, especially outside of the doer. And from that perspective, that is what doing is. That's what creating is. You can see it, because you've got now the perspective. So sometimes the job has to be as a tadpole. Learn how to get out of that lake, just for the first time, to get a glimpse. That's also why it's frightening. Sometimes some of you have got enmity, just got your head above the lake just for a few moments, and then you pop it down again. Because it's frightening, you're going to places you've never been before. Experiences which are very, very strange and weird, which are far from the experiences you've had before. That's why it's frightening. But for someone who is committed to truth, who's got the courage to find out what's real no matter what it takes, then you have the opportunity to go through that fear, past that fear. I said, there's also another encouragement, incitement, just to see a pleasure of this path. That sometimes is enough to push you into the jhanas, to overcome your fear, and to see non-self. That's why you cannot take yourself into a jhana. That's why in the jhanas there's not much chance of attachment. There's nothing left to do any attaching anymore. The hand can't go in. You have to leave it alone. That's why you've been all this last few days, till you let go, don't do anything. Because that's preparing you to enter the jhana states. So if you want to sleep, sleep. If you want to sort of walk, walk. If you want to sit, but just don't control. The way which I've taught this retreat is not just trying to be soft and getting more disciples. I've got too many disciples. I'm trying to get rid of disciples. The point which I teach this retreat is not to be popular. And say, oh, Ajahn Vaz retreats are really, really nice. You know, you don't have to get up early in the morning like other people's retreats. I'm not trying to increase my market share. You're doing this because I know this is the way. This is the way to encourage you and lead you to do even more letting go. You just make a routine of ease, of letting go, of non-controlling. And hopefully that's giving the message to the mind to do even more letting go when you sit. To do even more letting go. So maybe you can get into those still and peaceful states. But as I mentioned just in passing, just the peaceful states in themselves sometimes aren't quite enough to get the first stage of enlightenment, of streaming, to see oneself. Even though it's there, right in front of you, the truth, the Tao of the Buddha saw, sometimes we're not looking. We don't really understand. We've got not got the framework trying to see what's right there before our eyes. Sometimes it's like that. Sometimes it's something you talk in front of your eyes and you can say, look, look, it's there, it's there, it's there, look, see, see, see. I don't know how many of you have had the experience when wearing glasses. I have to wear glasses for reading now. Sometimes I've lost my glasses. And I must confess, I know this is an old joke, and sometimes I can't find my glasses until I realise they're on my nose. It's happened. Right, so similarly, what happens when you get into jhanas? You see, where's the insight? Where's the insight? Look, it's on your nose. It's right there. So this is why the Buddha said, there's two causes for the first stage of enlightenment, streaming. And the first one is yoniso manasika. Sometimes people translate that as wise attention, but that misses too much. The original Pali, yoniso manasika, it literally means, manas is mind, kara is work, work of the mind, that's what that word means. And yoniso is the most important one. It literally means which goes to the womb, which goes to the source. Yoni is a word for womb in Pali. What it literally means is work of the mind which goes to the source of things, which goes to the origin of things, which goes to the center. So it's not just wise attention, because wise attention could be on anything. That's actually wise attention is like manisikara. This is wise attention which goes to a particular place of experience, the source. And you can understand now what that source is. You go deep inside. The source of knowing to the source of doing. To know to what keeps you going, what's running you, what's at the heart of this person you call me. Now that yonisa manasikara is what we mean by the path of jhanas. It leads to those deep states. You're going in to the source, to the womb of things, where this world is born. Now, you understand what that one is, to go to the source and center of things. In that scene of the thousand petal lotus, it's like opening up things to see what's inside. When the Russian dolls, and what's in the center of this? You've got to go in, that's yonisa manasikara. And the second cause of stream winning is called paratogosa. It is the words of another. What that means is you also start the yeast which you have to put in bread. Something which comes outside of you just to be able to ferment the insights which lead to enlightenment. Those words of another are explained very clearly. It's like the teachings of Dhamma coming from someone who themselves has experienced the truth. You need some help. And that help is just the teachings of the Buddha. The teachings of not-self, the teachings of the Four Noble Truths, the deep teachings. That is why I teach, that is why the Buddha taught, to provide that other ingredient which gives rise to enlightenment. So once you have that framework, once you have the suggestion, once actually someone even told you that there's nobody in there, that much is good enough. Because when you go in there, now that possibility exists for you. That framework has been suggested. And it opens the possibility that the mind can see it. If that's never even been pointed out to you, then you can actually go into those jhanas if you don't see anything. It's one of the problems with perception. We need the framework to be able to understand how it relates to everything. It's why that some people actually do get jhanas. I know some lay people spontaneously get these jhanas, they've never been Buddhists before, haven't got a clue what they're doing. They sit down someplace, sometime, they let go, and they just wash right inside and go into these bliss states, they haven't got a clue what's going on. Having a great time, they come out, they're frightened, they're confused, they haven't got a clue what's happened. And I've met people like that. And sometimes you say, oh, if only they'd got some instruction first of all, they knew what was going on and why it was going on and what was happening, they had a framework for it, and they had some idea of actually what it means, so they can actually use that for getting to be a stream winner, seeing oneself. So that's the two things which are necessary, the words of another and Jnana Savana Sipa, the work of the mind which goes into the source of things. You get some understanding of Dhamma, Buddhism, some good understanding, clear understanding, precise understanding, and you also get the centering of the mind in deep meditation called jhanas. The two are necessary. In the sutta where that is actually said, it goes further and gives the five supporting factors of getting into the stream winning. Those five supporting factors are also very important, and they answer a question which came in question time a few days ago. The five supporting factors for stream winning are sila, your precepts, your virtues, number one. Next one is like learning. Literally means what you've heard, but it's the euphemism, the idiom for your learning, your understanding of Dhamma. Sakaccha, which is your discussion of Dhamma. That's why we have question time, as well as giving the talks. We make this retreat in such a way that we try and fulfill all of these five factors. You have your precepts, your virtues, practice. That's one ingredient. You have the talk, you know, the learning, explaining what's going on. That's the second factor, sutta. S-U-T-A, if you're writing it down. And the third factor is sakaccha. That's the discussion, the question and answers, which are important. It's one of the ingredients. The reason is, you may say something, but you may not understand it, either because I wasn't articulate enough, and I said one thing and meant another, which happens, actually more often than it should, but never mind, that happens. Or I might say it exactly, but you may misinterpret it. Sometimes there's a lot of change happens between the time words come out of somebody's mouth until the time they go in your ears. Somehow or other it gets confused on the way. So sakaccha makes sure that what is actually said, you question, answer, so it clarifies and makes more precise what those teachings are. And the last two factors are samatha vipassana. So this practice which you'll be doing here, the calm insight, the peace and the view, the stillness and the seeing. So those are the five factors which are there, necessary for insight, the seeing of the stream winner. So if you've only got samatha vipassana, it's not enough. If you've only got sutta and sakaccha, you're the study person, it's not enough. If you've got the study, you've got the practice of meditation, but you haven't got sila, it's not going to go deep enough. You do need all of those factors there, your virtuous conduct, your learning, your discussion, and your two types of meditation practice all joined in one of calm and insight. When all those five are in place, you've got the supporting factors. You're going to go deep. That's the Yoga Samana Sikara. You've got the words of another, the teachings of the Buddha, and they all come together in the streaming experience. Sila is important. If someone has got ill will, they're unkind to others, they have a bad temper, your virtue is not very good. You get angry and mean to other people, and that means that one of those factors aren't there. It means that you have a hard time getting to be stream winning. So this is why the virtue is important, and I've also mentioned the other importance of virtue. When nimittas come up, it's very clear as an experience why virtue is important, because the nimittas are dull. They haven't got their brightness and the power, if you like virtue. So those are the five factors. And then what happens? What happens is you get into deep meditation. And in those deep meditation experiences, you can't get insight within the jhanas. The mind is too still. The jhanas themselves are the causes for insight. It's not the moment of insight. In the same way, you know, sometimes people actually quote the suttas. They say, oh, well, all these people that sometimes they weren't in jhana when they listened to a talk by the Buddha, but they got enlightened. So that proves you don't need jhanas to become enlightened. And I said, actually, I've seen people get degrees. I never seen them going to any lectures or doing any assignments. I just turned up at the convocation hall in the university and I see they just roll up. All you've got to do is wear this funny gown and get your name called out, and then you get this degree. Have you seen that? People get their degrees? Because I haven't been watching when they've been going to all their lectures and when they're doing all their assignments. Sometimes the only thing the parents see is when you actually get your final piece of paper. And that's why I say sometimes in the suttas, all you see is that ceremony when you get your final piece of paper, stream winner, enlightened. It doesn't actually record all the hard work which went before that final moment when they got the degree from the Buddha. But you do need all of those factors there to be able to get the degrees of enlightenment. So what actually happens? You get into deep meditation. And at that time, you don't know what's going on, but you're still, you're very mindful, you're blissed out. When you come out afterwards, it's inevitable that you think, what was that? And one of the most powerful experiences of your life in this deep jhana is the strangest and weirdest, because like the tadpole going out of the lake, you're going to think, what was that? It's the nature of that experience that you hold it up in front of you and contemplate it to try and find out what it meant, what it was, why it was, where it came from, what it means. And the point is, if you have the framework, if you have the instructions, you know enough Dhamma, enough teachings of the Buddha, to say, is that what it meant by non-self? Is that what it meant by this will business? There you have the framework. And if you have the framework and the experience is deep enough, then suddenly it's going to go bang. Like an explosion happening in your consciousness. And the bliss just continues. You haven't got a clue what's happening, but this is nice and it's good. But usually one has to wait, sometimes even for years, for the dust to settle. Because at that time, when you have the powerful deep insights, it looks as all the defilements in the world have disappeared. It looks as if you're fully enlightened. And, to all intents and purposes, that's what it's like to be fully enlightened. The trouble is, when the dust settles, you'll find that some of the big attachments, unfortunately, are still standing. You weaken their foundations, but they're still standing, they're not destroyed yet. You're not enlightened yet. When I was a monk, a young monk, 4 years I was a monk at a particular time, and I was a diligent meditator, I was meditating so well in this monastery in the northeast of Thailand. I was sitting a long time, walking meditation, it was a good retreat, it was during the rain retreat, and I remember clearly one evening I was walking meditation, and it happened. This was it. The mind went just so still. It had these amazing insights. And they just cascaded like a waterfall once you get the first one. It's just so obvious. Anatta and non-self and all the places I've been clinging to before. I really thought this was the big one. Enlightenment at last. And it was just so peaceful, so blissful. You couldn't see any defilement, craving at all in your mind. It's a shame that many of you have heard this story before, otherwise it's really fun when you tell it for the first time. I haven't. Oh, well, you're going to hear it now. This is when I became enlightened. The thing was, it didn't last very long. That's why I don't want to say it, because it wasn't really enlightened. And the result of that great insight, I was just like, I was just so light and so full of energy. And it was late at night, 11, 12 o'clock. And you have to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning for your morning chanting. And so, usually you'd gone to bed way before then. But I just had so much energy, so much peace, I thought, I don't want to go to bed. And we're just so happy, so peaceful. Well, you got about 1 o'clock. I thought I should lie down for at least a little bit. Because you've got to get up at 3 o'clock. I don't want to fall asleep during chanting. So, I lay down, but I don't know if I had a sleep or not a sleep. But you know, one of these very, very light sleeps. You're laying down, but you know, you're probably mindful. You're just very relaxed. Got to 2:30, the bell hadn't gone yet. So I'm going to get up and go to the hall to meditate some more. And usually, this is in the tropics, in the monsoon season. You're laying down there, and when the bell goes, oh no, already? I don't want to get up. And usually you drag yourself to the hall, and you start meditating, you do the chanting. Sometimes it's like our chant in the morning. You've got no energy, you've got no life in it. So it's really, really dull. So that's what it was usually like. But this morning, you're up there, 2:30, and you're just bright as a button. Meditation is just so easy. You don't have to worry about stray thoughts, you know, about sort of mind going here. You sit down, the mind stays immediately. Straight on the breath, straight into the peace. Oh, this is just so nice. So easy. But this is it. I am enlightened at last. And the chanting is full energy. You really get off on the chanting, and after it's back, sitting absolute straight back, no sleepiness at all, even that time in the morning. Ah, it's just so wonderful being enlightened. And even going on, I was on that morning, I thought, should I tell the abbot, should I not tell the abbot? I said, who cares, I'm enjoying this. Now, in those monasteries, in those days, this is one of the brightest monasteries of Ajahn Chah's in a remote area, as usual, the food was disgusting. The food you used to get there was not, well, sometimes you've got frogs, but the common food there was what was called pladeg, which was like literally means rotten fish. What would happen was the villagers would catch the fish in the paddy fields, only tiny fish, and for the hot season or other times of the year, and of course this during the rainy season, they hadn't caught the new fish yet, we're still using the old fish from the year before. And they'd shove them in a jar, and they'd just put some plastic on the top and leave them. So they'd sort of like go off, they'd decay a little bit, and that was called rotten fish. And it really was rotten fish, and it smelt like rotten fish. And one day, to tell you what I meant, one day, this was in Wat Nanachat, I was cleaning around the kitchen area, that was my job that afternoon, and I saw this an old jar on the ground. So I picked it up, and it was one of these jars of rotten fish, and the plastic covers, only like polity, had been broken. It was crawling with maggots. The maggots feeding with maggots. And so I took it up to throw it away. At that time, the headman of the village, who was the most educated, refined, to be headman, you have to, you know, it's a big village, had to be elected. So he was the most refined, educated, most highly esteemed man in the whole village. He came out and said, what are you doing? I said, oh, it's gone off, but you've got maggots in it. I'm going to throw it away. He said, don't do that! That's extra protein! So he took it away from me. And the following morning, we had rotten fish curry again. Well, that's true, that happens. So at this monastery, after a while you sort of get used to it, but every day it was rotten fish curry. Every day, rice and rotten fish curry. Sometimes you had, the sweets were nice. And you had some fruit, you know, in the season. And there was a bit of fruit around in that time of the year, so that was okay. But just this rotten fish curry all the time, and you ate it because you had to. There's no other choice. But this one day, the morning of my enlightenment, I couldn't believe it. There was 2 pots of curry that morning. And 1 pot was a pork curry. Now, I know about the question about vegetarianism yesterday, but there's just no vegetables in those areas. It was that or nothing. So I had pork curry, and that pork curry smelled edible. I wouldn't say delicious, but I mean, when you have rotten fish curry every day, now that was just amazing. And immediately I saw that, I thought, this is interesting. We never had that before. And I thought, I know why. The heavenly beings decided to celebrate my enlightenment. So I thought, oh, it's obvious, you know, what's happening? So that's all right, I like that. And of course, you see this in monasteries, that the head monk gets the first choice. Just like, you know, I go first in to get the best of the food from, you know, the what's given in the kitchen there. But in this one, it's only a few months, so the pots were actually given to the top monk, the abbot, first of all, and then they were passed down the line. So the abbot got the first choice. I was second in line. And I watched the abbot. And the abbot was a local boy. He actually came from that village. He grew up on rotten fish. And then he looked at the rotten fish and just turned his nose away from that and took about three or four whopping ladlefuls, I mean huge ladlefuls, of this pork curry and stuffed it into his bowl. First of all, I thought, no, that's actually quite greedy. Yeah. But I didn't really care because there's lots left for me. There's plenty in there. So then what he did next was unbelievable. Having slopped three or four big ladles of the pork curry into his bowl, he never touched the rotten fish curry. He took the pork curry, lifted it up and started pouring it into the rotten fish curry and stirring it up. And then he turned around and said, it's all the same anyway, it's all the same anyway. And I thought, but it was all the same anyway, why didn't you mix it up before you take yours? You hypocrite, you greedy pig. You don't tell anybody except yourself. What kind of animal do you think you are? That's really unfair. I was really angry. And I could reason for Bill. He used to take it off himself and mix them all up before he passed them down. That was just really. But then an insight came. I got this amazing insight. The insight was that enlightened people don't get angry, they don't do it. Oh no! I realized I wasn't enlightened after all. And that was more depressing than missing your beautiful pork curry. One moment you were just as high as you could ever be, the next minute you were just as low as you could ever be. And I just lopped a couple of spoonfuls of this curry. I didn't care what I ate now. So that was actually when I became enlightened. I wasn't enlightened after all. But it should tell me a great lesson that sometimes you can have these amazing insights based on deep meditation. And everything is gone. All your defilements have disappeared. And you're so peaceful and so at ease and so free. And it's like being enlightened. But you've got to wait. Because sometimes enlightenment can be deceptive. It's only after a while, when the dust settles, then you can see what's left. And that's also why I said yesterday, sometimes if someone comes up and says they're enlightened, you sometimes try and make them angry and upset. On purpose. Just to make sure, you know, that they are really enlightened and they're not really fooling us. And it's sometimes very hard to say. This is one case which happened recently, which was a lesson to all senior monks and anyone else. Because this was in actually Mikkagala Monastery, one of the famous meditation monasteries in Sri Lanka. And at that time, the teacher was Venerable Abhijñanarama. Is that his name? I think it was. Yeah, but he was a very famous meditation master. And, you know, the most experienced, wisest, and probably the whole of Sri Lanka at the time. And in Sri Lanka, sometimes they had temple boys just, you know, doing odd jobs. They're sent there by their parents to do odd jobs in the monastery, and sometimes they go to school during the day. And this particular time, I had two temple boys. Both temple boys actually went to see the master one day and said, look, we're staying in the monastery, we're Buddhists. You know, we'd like to do some meditation as well. And when you have like a temple boy, only like young kids, so interested, the teacher was actually quite impressed, and so he gave them personal instruction. And these two boys made incredible progress. They came back to him and said, yeah, we've done that, teach us some more. And they started going through all of these deep levels. And of course, the abbot could not sort of keep it quiet. All the monks there at the time started hearing this amazing progress. And the monks there at the time said, oh, they were just so inspired. They're excited. They're two fully enlightened beings that have arisen in the world at such a young age. Imagine just the teaching or maybe the powers they could develop afterwards. And they said, oh, it's just a wonderful time. Now, because you've heard me say this before, that if you become enlightened, you've got in some traditions you've got 7 days to actually to join the Sangha or you die. In this part of Sri Lanka they thought it was only 1 day. So as soon as the other thought they were enlightened, he stopped everything, ordered a car, took them to the main monastery and demanded they be ordained immediately. In Sri Lanka you don't do that. To get an ordination is very, very difficult. Sometimes only do one or two a year. In this particular case, it was imperative. So everybody stopped what they're doing, all their appointments got cancelled while they ordained these 2 monks, or 2 little boys, while there was still a chance. So they both became monks. But unfortunately, what happened later, one of the boys, he had some sort of small problem with his body. He's got a doctor, and the doctor said, yeah, it's only a small problem, but we have to give you an operation. He said it to Colombo. It's only a minor procedure. Operations were. All he knew was they'd cut you open with a knife. He didn't understand about anaesthetic. And as soon as he heard that, he started getting afraid. You can't cut me open with a knife. That's going to hurt. He'd actually, and it was basically confirmed, he wasn't enlightened. I had fooled the greatest teacher in the whole of Sri Lanka at the time. He glass or whatever. But it's hard to tell they're not. You've got to wait until some defilement comes up, some craving, some greed comes up, and then you know they're not enlightened. So that's only stream winning. Once one becomes a stream winner, it's only a matter of time. The cause of the second shipwrecked sailor bobs up, goes down, bobs up, goes down, and they're wading to shore. They're that close. And the seventh shipwrecked sailor is the one who's made it to the shore, is now sitting under the coconut tree, enjoying a nice rest. 7 shipwrecked sailors. The meaning of those 7 shipwrecked sailors is this. The first shipwrecked sailor, who goes right down, that's the person who hasn't made much good karma. They go right down. The second shipwrecked sailor is the one, the ordinary person. Now they go up, now they go down. Now you can't really say that they've got bad precepts. They've not got good precepts, just the ordinary person. The average Joe and Joanne. So the average person. The third shipwrecked sailor, the one who always floats above, keeps your head above water, that's the virtuous one. They're always managing to keep their precepts, to give a really good standard in their life, they're the virtuous one. And it's only the virtuous ones can become the 4th, 5th, 6th, and 7th shipwrecked sailors. Only when you're floating above the surface can you look around and you can see the shore, you can see safety. That is the stream winner. The one who sees the Dharma, who sees safety, who sees the end of rebirth, who sees the end of suffering. They haven't reached it yet, they see how it's over there. And the next shipwrecked sailor, the one who's swimming towards the shore, is called the once returner. You're on the way. The person who is actually so close to the shore, they're standing up in the surf, wading, they don't have to swim anymore, they're wading for the shore, that's the non-returner, the anagama. The anagama non-returner is so close to enlightenment, this hardly counts. And the last one, the 7th one, has made it to the shore, that's the enlightened one. So that's a very beautiful simile told by the Buddha of the stages of enlightenment. I've only talked so far about seeing anatta, seeing the Dhamma, seeing the emptiness there. Once you see that, quite naturally you swim towards the shore. Which means that your cravings, your anger, your ill will, your striving starts to diminish. You start to let go, let go, let go. As you're almost swimming towards emptiness. And when you're a non-returner, the anagami, you're standing in the surf. There's nothing left, hardly. The surf actually is the jhanas. You're standing in those beautiful states. You're so close towards enlightenment. Still got a ways to go, but it's hardly any distance at all. And the final one, the arahant, they've already gone. So those are the stages of enlightenment. They all depend upon that seeing non-self. Seeing there's nobody here. There's no one to protect. There's no one to do anything. That's the end of suffering. So, do you still want to become enlightened? Unfortunately, it's too late. You've heard these teachings. I'm sorry. It's gonna happen. So, there's a talk about enlightenment. Any questions? Yeah? Sorry, can you speak up? Because I can hear that. Yes. The four Nidhikara is the will. That actually is what puts you on the path. It's the will to let go. Basically, just what the Nidhikaras are, it's like Chanda. A Chanda Samadhi, Virya Samadhi, Chitta Samadhi, and Rangsa Samadhi. And what it really means, like Chanda is sometimes called will, but it means more than that, because it is the same word. It uses the same word actually to give permission, like no worries. That's Chanda. It means to give consent. So use that as like a monk, because we actually live this life, much of our rules were written in Pali. And when you see these words like in their Pali, as they're used in daily life, you have a much better understanding what these words mean. That particular first thing, which is sometimes means will, is also the word like to give your proxy. So for example, the monks in my monastery are making some business decision, and I'm not there, I say, oh, no, whatever you want to do, go and do it. That's giving my chanda, giving my proxy, giving my will to proceed. Now you can see there that that is a letting go, a permission for things to carry on without me. In the original Pali, the whole word, which is the first of the Nidhikaras, and perhaps the most important, the one which gives it the idea of like will, and in the Western sense of the word, also includes intrinsically letting go. The will to just let things happen and not get involved. And that's the Nidhikara. And you know that's the way, because the way the Nidhis also means power. The way to get that power coming up is to abandon, to let go. The Nidhis are also the word for psychic powers, and the way that psychic powers come is from empowering the mind in the path of letting go. So the Nidhikaras, from the understanding, understand the Pali, it's more than just the Western idea of will. It includes, and in this particular case it focuses on, literally the will just to go ahead. Not to get involved. The consent to proceed in my absence. Does that make sense? Okay. Another question. No. Going. Okay, so now you've had the, what's called the paratagosa, the words of another. You've got half of what it takes to become a monk. You've got all of the right information. That ingredient is right there. Now all you need to do is to check it out. To find the driver's seat. Who is scratching their legs? Who is lifting their head? Who decided to smile? Who is bending over? Who is swabbing their knees? Who picked up the water? Who did that? Find out the driver of your vehicle called your life and your mind. And be prepared once you get to the driver's seat. You'll understand what I mean. That is no one there. There's no one there. Then you can relax. You've got nothing to do. Because there's no one to do the doing. Okay, so now we can have our interviews. So those of you who are on the list for today, if you don't want to come, please put an X by your name. If you want to come, please come. Just to let everybody know that tomorrow's Saturday, there is another interview period, but that is free flow. So whoever comes in, I'll put the
a list out there, but it would just be blank spaces. So please put in the names of your non-self on those blank selves, so I know which non-self in particular is coming. Okay, so just put the list down, you can put your name down if you want to interview tomorrow. So there's still another chance for personal interviews. But hopefully some of you will become enlightened. You won't need any more interviews, you'll put a big cross on there. Never needing an interview ever again. Oh, wouldn't that be nice? Okay, so I'll see you in the room in a couple of minutes. Thank you.